Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. If you want to be part of the program tonight, we would be more than happy to welcome you at 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet. 530-413-4515 east of Earth, and 530-413-4520 west of Earth. We also welcome all of those who are listening by cell phone out there. If you wish to join them, if you're going to duck out from the house, just call 712-432-0075 and access code 318-116-POUND. The solar wind tonight is 570 kilometers per second, and the proton count is an average 3.5. Now, some people ask me from time to time, why do we report on the solar wind? Because those of you that listen every week can sort of track it in your mind, say, oh, 570, that's pretty brisk. That means that the sun is putting out a lot of energy and buffeting the magnetosphere of the Earth, which means there's a high likelihood of an aurora, which there is tonight. Sunspot 1140 is there, but quiet and stable. And there are lights above the northern pole tonight. There were also 36 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with five of them over 5.0 and two of them over 6.0. Now, those of you that listen to that statistic each week know there's usually an average of 24 earthquakes with maybe two or three over 5.0, but that means that the Earth is vibrating pretty well. Now, we've been doing a scatter plot between the solar wind, the presence of sunspots, and the presence of earthquakes for about 2 years now, and we see some correlation. Some, I say, it's not a great line fit, but there is some correlation. We have a lot of news tonight. I'm going to cover that. I want to let you know that Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, has a second edition out now. We had, well, perhaps some haste as we put out Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, and there were some typographical errors and different things that we missed, and I decided to go back, fix those, maybe put in just a little bit more information. I did not increase the page count very much, but it did reach number 4 on Amazon in spiritual, motivational, and number 9 in the genre of self-help, which is what we wanted to do. We wanted to reach the top 10 in self-help. That is a tremendous genre that has been left vacuous by real scientific cross-thought. There's, of course, a lot of opinion and not very much study. This book has a lot of condensed information in there in a readable format, and there is, of course, some time travel in there because we do expose you to the physics portion of the theory, and that is that time is merely a mathematical access, and we teach you how to do that in the book. We teach you how to observe the past and observe the future and thus affect both and bring back the memories of those encounters to the present, which is valuable to you. So if you want to get it, you can get it by going to any online purchaser, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc., etc. Or if you wanted the autographed version, And we give you, I give you the bonus of the entire book recorded in audio as a bonus for free if you buy the hardback from our website. That's a couple dollars more, but not much. Go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and you can make your purchase there through PayPal, whether you have a PayPal account or not. Also, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, and it doesn't take someone who is astute in studying meteorology to know that the weather is doing some crazy things. If you missed our special on weather weirdness, you can go back and listen to last week's program. If you are not an archive subscriber, you can fix that very easily by going to xsquaredradio.com. Just spell it all out, xsquaredradio.com. Click on the subscribe button, and it's like 1, 2, 3. $20 a year, and you can listen to almost 1,000 hours of archives. If you can't afford $20, we understand. We have a $2.50 price, which will give you 30 days of unlimited, unfettered access to everything we've got. You might not get any sleep for a month, but you'll have access. Just go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the archives button, and it'll take care of you automatically. While that weather is doing weirdness, you're going to be out driving in it or being driven in it, or you're going to be in a remote area living in it, and you might need some emergency supplies. You might slide off into the snow or have somebody who doesn't know how to drive in this stuff crash into you and strand you for several hours out there. So we recommend that you have an emergency preparedness kit in your vehicle. And for our advice, the best place to get that emergency preparedness kit is from our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com. My friend Paul Faust and his partner, both former firefighter EMTs in New York, saw a need for organized, price-conscious, well-packaged emergency preparedness kits that people could buy, put in their trunk, put in their closet, set it and forget it, and it's good for 25 years. You need to do that. We're recommending that you do that. Don't be a burden upon the emergency preparedness officials. Don't be herded like cattle because you don't have the ability to filter your own water or you don't have 72 hours worth of food for you and yours, neighbors, children, grandchildren, whatever. Go to 1-800-PREPARE.com and take care of it now. And on your way to checking out, put in my name, Brooks, in the coupon code, and you'll get an extra 10% off. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. These are short 30-minute versions of the program. We're still trying to boost the interest in that. There are about 10 or 12 segments on there. If we can show enough interest in that, then we can make our way to syndication. Really don't want to pour a whole lot more money into that because if it isn't going to take off on its own, I can't continue to breathe life into it. So listen or don't listen, it's your choice. Tonight, we are going to cover some of the hottest news. No, we are not going to cover what happened in Tucson. That's a different program. We don't do that stuff here. But we are going to cover the what we covered briefly in the first hour, or second hour, last week. Now we have more information. Now we're going to give you a little bit more on the very strange wildlife deaths that we have seen over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, Norway, Japan, etc. Many, many thousands and thousands of animals, all kinds of different species, all kinds of different genuses. And now we have kind of a reason why. So we're going to start that in 40 seconds. Fasten your seatbelt. Here we go. We'll be back. Don't go away.
Expands consciousness. the spice flight of space travel.
All right, we very briefly introduced HAARP to you last week, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. You know that I do not speak as a journalist on this. I speak as a reviewing scientist. I've been involved in two documentaries and also History Channel and True TV specials on HAARP. So I am a consulting scientist on citizen advocacy for civilian review and oversight of HAARP. So I know what I'm talking about. The deaths that we saw of perfectly healthy birds dropping out of the sky in Arkansas and then later in Texas and then also in Louisiana were very similar to those that we saw in Tennessee some years back when a HAARP signature, that is a telltale radio signal that is picked up by ham operators because HAARP operates in the 2-meter range with a phased array of square wave antennas that ham operators can pick up with their antennas, and they report on this. We have not been able to confirm that there was a HAARP signature at the same time that there were the bird deaths. This is significant because there's no way that HAARP would have that effect unless it was running. And so we went looking for another source, and lo and behold, there has been some publication very recently, like in the last few weeks, of a correlative cause, and that is the shifting magnetic pole. Now, you know that I participated in Brent Miller's special called The Horizon Project back in 2008. This was a study on the likelihood and the effects of a Earth magnetic pole shift. And we were specifically discussing in this documentary a 180-degree shift. In other words, North Pole becoming South, South becoming North. We're not talking about a 90-degree shift or a crustal shift or something like that. We're just talking about a swap of the poles, a redirection of the flux through the Earth in an opposite direction. It happens on the Sun every 11 years. It happens on the Earth every, and that's a good question, how many years? Some say every 100,000, some say every 300,000. You're going to hear some scientists, affiliated scientists, tonight. We have some audio clips for you, and we'll offer some supporting documentation. And here we go. Magnetic pole movement. At the moment, it's located in northern Canada, about 600 kilometers from the nearest town, Resolute Bay, population 300. They have popular t-shirts that read, Resolute Bay isn't the end of the world, but you can see it from here. Scientists have long known that the magnetic pole moves. My ancestor, yes, my great-great-grandfather, Sir James Ross, located the pole for the first time in 1831 after an exhausting Arctic journey during which his ship got stuck in the ice for 4 years. No one returned until the next century. In 1904, Roald Amundsen found the pole again and discovered that it had moved at least 50 kilometers since the days of Ross. Now, we're just talking about 69 years here, 75 years. It moved 50 kilometers. That's a big shift. Now, it wasn't really studied with great impact because perhaps the resolution of the instruments wasn't such that it was really given a lot of credulity, or perhaps the world community wasn't really concerned about the North Magnetic Pole. It just didn't mean a whole lot then. But it is having a meaning now. This is a very, very recent article. The steady and rapid movement of the magnetic North Pole may be responsible for the recent sudden and mysterious death of thousands of birds and millions of fish in the U.S., also Russia, by the way. In the last week, nearly 100,000 fish washed up on the shores of the Arkansas River, dead. Also in Arkansas, thousands of red-winged blackbirds fell from the sky and plummeted to the ground, where they were also found dead. Now, just so you know, sick birds don't fly. Poisoned birds don't fly. If they're sick, they will roost until they keel over dead and fall to the ground. Only healthy birds fly. So these birds are flying in the skies by the thousands, moving back and forth like schools of fish, as though some telepathic communication exists between them. Turn left, turn right, go up, don't go down. You've seen it 1,000 times when you're driving down the freeway or a country road. These birds just fell out of the sky. And they're not high-altitude birds. These birds fly less than 300 feet off the ground. The scene repeated itself in southern Louisiana, where 500 red-winged blackbirds recently plunged out of the sky, dead on arrival. And in Chesapeake Bay, thousands of dead fish have become washing up onto bay shores. Recently, several million animals have mysteriously died in the United States, although some thought that it might have been the cause related to fireworks, disease, sudden cold, high-altitude winds. The cause may be more obvious, the steady but rapid movement of the magnetic pole toward Russia. Now, this is a short list. There's lots more. I'm sure you can call in and give me more, and I encourage you to do so. This is a short list of the mysterious bird deaths and fish death incidences that have occurred in the United States. On New Year's Eve, 5,000 red-winged blackbirds plunged to their death. On the 3rd of January, 100,000 fish wash up dead in Arkansas. On the 4th of January, 500 birds were found littering a Louisiana highway. On the 5th of January, hundreds of birds fall out of the sky in Murray, Kentucky. On the 6th of January, thousands of turtle doves fall from the skies dead in Italy. On the 6th of January, also, 2 million fish that wash up on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. And also on the 6th, 40,000 crabs wash up dead on the coastline near Kent, England. Now, navigation systems of birds, fish, and other wildlife is commonly accepted to be governed by magnetism. According to The New Scientist, birds that navigate using the Earth's magnetic field rely more on their eyes than on the magnetic particles in their nostrils. An experiment on robins suggests that careful tests with homing pigeons and other birds displayed the ability to judge direction show that the birds are affected by changing magnetic fields, and they are. Additionally, a team of scientists in New Zealand have brought us another step closer to understanding the magnetic sense of the trout, indicating that the trout's compass is inside its head, near the nose. They found that a freshwater fish, the trout, would respond to a magnetic field. Also, sharks do exactly the same thing. The shift of the magnetic north over the past century has been tracked at a rate of a stunning 25 miles, not per century, not per decade, 25 miles per year. 25 miles per year. That's not 2 feet. That's not 6 inches. That's across a major city per year. Compass needles in Africa, for instance, are drifting about 1 degree per decade. And globally, the magnetic field has weakened 10% since the 19th century. Now, people, we're in the 21st century. This is one millennia. This is a cosmic flashbulb in the lifespan of the Earth, believed to be somewhere around 4.5 billion years old. The magnetic field has weakened 10% in the last 1,000 years. Another factor to consider is that the Earth's magnetic poles flip regularly. Well, now I want to help you understand what regularly means. We believe, based on geological records, that over the last 330 million years, the poles have juxtaposed 400 times, or an average of once every 825,000 years. The last such time was approximately 780,000 years ago, making us statistically within one standard deviation. A standard deviation is the is a plot of the least squares of the differences of the mean. So just so you know, standard deviation is a very small number when you're considering a large population. Considering that these reversals take approximately 1,000 years to complete, and the massive move and reduction in strength may be within a handful of generations away for such a magnetic North Pole reversal, more evidence of the effect of the movement of the magnetic north may be needed. I would caution science and say that these flips do not necessarily take 1,000 years. The sun is, for instance, much, much larger than the earth, many orders of magnitude more massive than the earth. And yet its poles flip every 11 years. You will hear that when we hear from Dr. Kaku here in just a minute or so. Scientists say the magnetic North Pole is moving toward Russia, and the fallout has reached, of all places, the Tampa International Airport. That's true. It's true. It's the first airport recently, like this month, January 2011. The airport has closed its primary runway until January 13th. You know why? Not to change the electronics. No, no. To repaint the numeric designators at the end and of each runway and taxiway to account for the shift in locations of the Earth's north magnetic pole. Now, people, the Tampa airport has not been there for 1,000 years. The Tampa airport hasn't been there for 100 years. And they're already sandblasting up the old numbers. These are the numbers that designate the compass heading of that runway at either end. They're sandblasting the numbers up and repainting new ones so that pilots will not be confused. Hey, I'm supposed to be coming in on runway 5, meaning 5 on the compass, and I'm actually looking at 6. What's wrong? You get the idea. Considering southern migration patterns and environmental cues that wildlife take, it would stand to reason that with the magnetic North Pole losing strength and moving over and across the true north toward Russia, away from the southern United States in distance and strength, it would stand to reason that the birds and fish, they might get confused as to their distance and direction from the locations they instinctively should be heading. But again, I got to throw in here, I'm not an ornithologist, but I can tell you blackbirds don't migrate. They are regional birds, and they hang around all winter long. They don't migrate. They stay in the area. You can tell. You see them. All winter long, all summer long, they're doing the same thing. They hang around the wheat fields. They hang around the corn fields. They hang around the soybean fields. They eat insects. They eat all kinds of leftover seeds on the ground. They are regional birds. So why are the blackbirds falling out of the sky? And why not just one or two at a time? Why thousands at a time? Why in one flight, in one day, one after, hey, guys, let's go for a fly. And they go out, and 1,000 of them drop out of the sky. Why is it sudden like that? Why is there an acute change? That's a very big question. Nobody has been able to answer yet. Nobody. Now, I want to be able to cover something a little bit here. Let's go ahead and we'll listen to the first video. This is This is the first one in the sequence that's going to talk about magnetic poles shifting.
The North Pole itself is changing. Follow me now. This problem is actually so drastic that workers at Tampa International and Peter O'Knight airports are rushing to make changes.
When most people hear North Pole, they think of Santa Claus. And while he'll always be at the very top of the world,
there's also a magnetic pole, which is produced by fluctuations or flow of iron in the core of the Earth.
Dr. Chris Conner of USF explains that the constantly moving molten iron acts like a giant car alternator, creating a magnetism on a planetary scale with the magnetic north and south pole.
It's been moving, and now it's moved all the way from northern Canada into northern Siberia.
Which means what your compass shows as north in Tampa Bay isn't really north. And this is a problem for airports.
When a pilot navigates, he needs to find what's the correct runway to land in or take off on. So he uses his compass in his cockpit to orient himself. That'll tell him that he's on the correct runway.
Robert Burr of TIA says runway 36 originally pointed due north to 360 degrees. Or it did before the magnetic shift. Now it points just right at 10 degrees north, even though physically it hasn't moved.
While the runway in question will always point to the true geographic North Pole, because the magnetic North Pole has now shifted, pilots who use compasses lining up on the runway may think they're in the wrong spot unless this problem is corrected.
So TIA has resolved to paint new numbers to match the pilot compass readings. Now runway 36 is runway 1. But this may only be a temporary fix. Several times per million years, Earth's magnetic pole does a full flip. At first, it becomes disorganized, with new poles popping up in odd places like the equator, bringing the green and red northern lights to the skies of Florida. The last shift was over 700,000 years ago, leaving some to say we're due.
Some people have speculated that there's a shift beginning,
which may explain this recent fluctuation. But because our lifetimes are a blink of an eye in the geological timescale, it's too soon to tell.
Birds and mm-hmm. wildlife out there could actually be confused by all of this.
If in fact...
Okay, now there's more to that story, but I'm going to cover that myself. Now, this is mainstream news. This is Channel 8 down in Tampa talking about the very thing that we were just discussing. So you can see that in the amount of time it took to lay the asphalt for that runway and paint the original numbers on that runway, the magnetic pole has shifted so far that pilots lining up in that runway, looking down at that runway, seeing the number painted on the approach, would see a different number than what they see on their compass and wonder, gee, am I at the right airport? You might not think that that's a serious thing or even a possible thing. But I could tell you what I witnessed one time. I was in Smyrna, Tennessee. Smyrna, Tennessee is where Nissan is. That's where I was working at the time. And as you know, Smyrna Airport was once Smyrna Air Base. It has a very nice, long, wide runway that's used for military aircraft, although it's now in private use. In other words, just private planes and a little bit of National Guard activity, nothing... No traffic, no scheduled traffic, very, very little freight coming in and out of that airport. In line, almost in line with that airport, just a few miles up the road, is the Nashville International Airport, BNA. I have watched jetliners drop their gear, drop their flaps, and be on approach to Smyrna, runway 32. Coming in just as sure and true as anything, realize, hey, that's not the BNA runway. Wrong number. Power up, regain altitude, go a few more miles, and land at BNA. Now, you'll call that airport and they'll deny that. But I sat there and watched it. Gear down, flaps down, low altitude, motors on a full 500-foot-per-minute glide path right for that runway. I've done it several times myself. Of course, I intended to land at that runway. So I can tell you that they made a mistake. They have to have clear numbers on that runway or we're going to have a tragic air accident. So you can see why Tampa took the measures that they did. Now, what does this mean? And who actually predicted that this would happen? It certainly wasn't me and Brent Miller and others who put together the Horizon Project. This kind of evidence has been mounting for a long, long time. However, it hasn't really been accepted by mainstream. Let me just read a little bit to you out of Scientific American. Now, Scientific American is a peer-reviewed magazine. It's a privilege to be published in it. Very few heretical ideas actually make it into Scientific American. It's not like Scientific Inquirer. Here we go. This is the Scientific American blog. According to some recent models, plumes of less dense fluid form at the inner core boundary and subsequently rise within a cylinder whose axis is the Earth's rotational axis. Such plumes undergo a strong helical motion, that is to say, a twisting circle, due to the Earth's rapid rotation, a phenomenon also observed in laboratory experiments with water. In the core, helical plumes advect and twist the magnetic field lines, forming what scientists call polar magnetic upwellings. Those upwellings, loaded into the Arctic mantle, could produce intense patches of magnetic activity on the sort of decade-long timescales needed to explain the North Magnetic Pole's sudden acceleration. The authors compare these patches to a kind of terrestrial version of sunspots. And magnetic field measurements show dramatic shifts near the New Siberian Islands that seem to fit the bill. Now, I'm going to put in parentheses right here. This is not part of the article, but it is part of the research that's been put together by the crew and the staff of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. It is north of the New Siberian Islands where we believe there is a high likelihood of an opening into the inside of the crust of the Earth. Now, it isn't that we are advocating this. It isn't that we believe that it is. We believe that there's a high likelihood that if there was one, it would be located there. Because there are these high gravitational fluctuations, these very rapid twisting magnetic fields that come up through the crust at that location. And if you couple with that the idea that this area has been covered by thick ice for well over 200,000 years and only recently has opened up to sea traffic. Now, I don't mean sea traffic like jump in a sailing vessel and go sail up there. I mean 75,000-ton nuclear-powered icebreaker sea traffic. Unfortunately, the fleet is very small. Only three boats right now can actually make that journey. And they've only been able to make that journey since 2007. And none of them have, which means no human being has ever sailed those waters. Now, that's just scientifically unacceptable, people. When we have the ability to go explore a place of our planet, and there's high interest in doing so, and now it seems scientific significance in doing so, it is remiss of the scientific community to not go there. Whether we lead the expedition or whether someone else leads the expedition is only going to be a function on who can raise the money first. If we raise the money first, we're going. And we're going to film it. And we're going to measure it. And maybe we'll bring back an answer to this question. If someone else does it, I wish them luck. And believe me, no one has worked harder than the crew and the staff of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition and Phoenix Science Foundation and making this happen. We've been working for many years, traveled to many nations, spoken in many cities, and taken unbelievable scientific risk to our reputations and our abilities to earn money for our families to bring you this information. And it has been a challenge. Now, let me continue with the article. What happened under the New Siberian Islands at the core surface is that the rate of change, that's the acceleration, the rate of change of the magnetic field changed by a large amount during the 1990s. Now, let me explain that to you again. The rate of change is not the speed. That's like going down the freeway on cruise control. The rate of change is the acceleration. That's stomping on the gas. That means that not only are you going fast, you're going faster. Okay? The rate of change of the magnetic field changed by a large amount during the 1990s, which means the acceleration of the change changed. That activity, the author says, he and his colleagues have found, would account for a large portion of the North Magnetic Pole's acceleration. But whether magnetic field changes under the New Siberian Islands and the speeding North Magnetic Pole ultimately arise from a twisted plume of fluid rising to the core remains unproved. Exactly. It remains unproved because nobody has been there. A resolution of the mystery will await better modeling, along with more data from satellites monitoring the Arctic magnetic environment. Don't you think it would be wonderful to monitor that Arctic magnetic environment from the Arctic? Yeah, me too. The necessity of satellites, interestingly enough, is a coincidence of the pole's recent movement. As the North Magnetic Pole drifts farther out to sea, it becomes harder and harder to reach the region with magnetometer-equipped aircraft. Exactly my point. That's why we have to do it by sea. Now, there are others that have thought about this. There are others that publish this. Now, you have heard me talk about professional risk. Well, there are physicists that took professional risks. They wrote books that were read and were excoriated by the professional scientific community and now are being more widely read because they're being heralded now as something perhaps more meaningful. The person you're going to listen to right now is someone that actually wrote a book called Worlds in Collision. His name is Emmanuel Velikovsky. I don't know if the audio quality is going to be very good, but I want you to listen to what he says very carefully.
The catastrophes described in ancient sources were traumatic experiences common to all mankind. Purged from conscious memory, these records are now interpreted as allegories, metaphors, and the trauma has been submerged in the unconscious. Collective amnesia. A revolutionary theory of the universe based on the records of the past has challenged the fundamental beliefs of modern science for more than two decades. Today, the unexpected findings of space explorations have confirmed many of the predictions of this theory. Mountains were born and mountains collapsed. Land and sea changed places. Great streams of lava flowed. The sea boiled and evaporated. Such were the scenes of unimaginable violence during the times of global catastrophe, as recorded by the ancients.
Here in the New York Herald Tribune, explosion in science, the artist's conception of what happened when the heavens burst. What happened during the 1500 B.C. Upheaval, which we read about in the Bible as the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, and the phenomena or upheaval that that accompanied that. And this is the artist's conception of what happened in Palestine and Mexico and China. Lightning, meteorites being rained down as the comet's head came closer to the earth, followed by floods. Same in Mexico, where water swept over the entire land, great gigantic tides.
There were repeated changes in the earth's orbit, in the lengths of day, the seasons, and the year. In these catastrophes, entire species of animals were annihilated. Others proliferated from wholesale mutations. Mankind was decimated. Civilizations destroyed. The papyrus of Ipuwer synchronized biblical and Egyptian events and led to a reconstruction of ancient history. Many questions debated for centuries found an answer. In the Bible, the identity of the beautiful Queen of Sheba at the court of Solomon was unknown. In Egyptian records, the land of Punt, visited by Queen Hatshepsut, could not be determined. In Velikovsky's reconstruction, it is clear that Punt is the land of Solomon and Hatshepsut is the Queen of Sheba. The biblical story of Joshua, with the sun standing still in Gibeon and the moon in the valley of Ajalon, presented another realization.
I was struck by the fact that two lines or two verses before the story of the sun and moon disturbed in their daily motion was the story of large stones that fell from the sky and destroyed more of the enemy soldiers than the sword of the Israelite. On this combination, because combination of stones and disturbance in rotation of the earth, the ancient could not know that it was the earth that was disturbed in rotation. They thought the moon and the sun. Made me immediately to follow the path toward east and west. And I found without great difficulty that in Western Hemisphere, which means here on this continent, the story persists too. The story persists among the Redskins, it persisted among the Mayas at the time when the continent was first conquered, the Mexico part of it. But
so you have evidence in the sky that's recorded by ancient historians that heavenly bodies stood still, that as the poles shifted, perhaps even the rotation of the earth was interrupted. Until it resumed, the heavenly bodies stood still for an inordinate amount of time, and that was recorded by scientists. Now, as Emanuel Velikovsky recorded in his book Worlds in Collision, and as he pontificated in this book about what kind of forces it would take for these events to have happened, those in Revelations, those in the Popol Vuh, those in the Kabbalah, certain astronomical conditions and even Earth conditions would have had to have existed. And that's what Emanuel Velikovsky wrote about. And that was, honestly, recently, I would say in the last 10 years, I was having a discussion at an astronomy club. I made a presentation at the observatory, and not part of my presentation, but an after discussion as we were out in the observatory looking through their 25-inch mirror at various nebula. That discussion came up, that Emanuel Velikovsky had been, you know, negated, that his evidence had been shown as a fable. And that was less than 10 years ago. I was in observatory doing that. So since that time, Emanuel Velikovsky has been vindicated on many, many things, and many mainstream scientists are now backing up what he says. That being said, they are publicly missing the mark. I will tell you, this is just the 7th of January, and we're going on more about this closing of the Tampa airport temporarily while the numbering system is corrected on the runway. The quote is, the poles are generated by movements within Earth's inner and outer cores through the exact process, though the exact process isn't well understood. They're also constantly in flux, moving a few degrees every year, but the changes are almost never of such a magnitude that runways require adjusting. And this is an FAA official, Paul Takamoto, who is making this comment. The runways listing on aviation charts will be changed from 18R36L, that is 18 right, 36 left, representing a 180-degree approach from the north and a 360-degree approach from the south. That's 18 and 16 is 180 and 360, to 19. So that's 10 degrees, 10 degrees difference. When Kaplan asked Takamoto, how often these kinds of adjustments were needed at airports, the FAA spokesman told him it happened so infrequently that they wouldn't even venture a guess. In fact, you're the first journalist to ever ask me about it. He was also quick to note that passenger safety will not be an issue, but that the changes were needed to make sure the precision is there that we need. Now, don't be worried about flying, because we use Omni. Omni is a signal that's broadcasted from each airport on a certain frequency, 360 different steps of that frequency, so that any pilot can dial in that Omni or two Omnis, different airports, and triangulate and fly in the dark, in the fog, in the smoke, with plastic over his windows, with nothing but a view of his instruments directly to that airport. I've done it many, many times. Any pilot that flies on instruments learns how to do that and has to be certified to do that. If you're flying VFR, if you make it out of ground school, you will know how to dial in Omni. And then there are other methods, not the least of which is GPS. And GPS, of course, is through satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit 23,500 miles out in space. And those satellites are being upgraded as we speak. They're a little behind schedule doing that. But the idea is that each aircraft that's in the sky has access to at least 10 and usually 12 different satellites, which make it easy for them to very precisely fly themselves directly to any particular airport that they want to. And most commercial aircraft are equipped with automatic landing systems. I'm sure if you've flown recently in the terrible weather that we've had, you have glided in the fog all the way right to the runway and landed right on the numbers. And believe me, that takes a lot of nerve to be able to hold onto those controls and follow that signal blindly, literally, right to the ground when you cannot see it in the dark, in the fog, in the rain, and you're going to land right on the numbers and then control that aircraft to a safe speed with passengers inside. It's a challenge. So that is one set of articles. Now, we're coming up on the top of the hour, and I got a lot more on this. So I want to make sure that that you realize the phone lines are open, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4515. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us. You can also listen to us via cell phone. If you want to get out there away from the computer, you will not be able to contribute, but you can listen. You dial in 712-432-0075 and then the access code 318-116-pound. And then you can listen to the entire program live. By the way, if you want to listen to X Squared Radio live, it's always free right here on BBS Radio Network. BBS Radio Network is, in my opinion, the largest internet radio network in the world. We have more hosts covering more subjects, been on longer, and have more traffic than any other internet radio network out there. If it isn't mainstream, it's probably right here on the BBS Radio Network. And X Squared Radio has been here now going, it's in its sixth year, and we're usually in the top one or two programs on the network. So you're in the right place. And what we want you to do this year, in 2011, we want you to tell your friends about X Squared Radio, because I have got a stack of very leading edge, very provocative books on my desk, which I am reading. And as I finish them, we contact the authors, we set up an interview, we bring them here, and you get 3 hours of that content uninterrupted. We don't do very many commercials here on X Squared Radio. We don't have to. Your subscription applications and regular archive subscriptions keep us going. And as long as you do that, we will do our part and not fill up all the air time with commercials. And I know you will appreciate that. Now, out there on the airwaves, we have a lot of pontificating going on. We have a lot of bloviating going on. We have a lot of fear-mongering going on. That's not what we do here. We go out, we get the facts, we bring those experts here. If we can't bring them in person on the air with you, then we will bring their publications here and their public statements here, and we'll talk about them with you. We want your opinion as well. We want your input. We want to hear if you're afraid. We want to hear what you're concerned about. And any questions you want to ask at all about any subject, I'm not Google, but, you know, I've got a little bit of knowledge here and a little bit of crosstown. And if you want to ask questions, we will certainly supply answers for you. We'll take a very quick break right now, and then we're going to come back with some comments by Michio Kaku. He's one of my colleagues in the physics community who is really serving the role of a modern-day Einstein now, because he is making the public statements, and he's so easy in front of people. And he's now a commentator on Fox News, which is one of the comments that we're going to play from him tonight. A couple of them are from him. And we really appreciate Michio. We communicate from time to time. I'd love to have him on the program. Obviously, I need him a lot more than he needs me. In this community, it's more about association, I guess, than anything else. We'll take a quick break, listen to a little Miasma, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming up after this.
Yeah.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're live every Sunday evening between 8 and 11 Eastern Time. And if you miss the live broadcast, you can always subscribe. So if you miss the first hour, it's not a problem. Go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the subscribe button. You can subscribe to the archives for $2.50 a month, or you can buy a whole year for $20. That's less than the cost of a bag of popcorn. What it does, it allows us to keep the lights on and not run a whole lot of commercials, and then we can run all information for you. It's sort of like a three-hour documentary every week. We often have authors and specialists and experts from all around the world. And all we talk about here are the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. We don't do conspiracy theories, and we don't do ghost stories. We do have a couple of conspiracy theorists that we have from time to time on the program, but they're well vetted, and we know that they do their research well. If you want to be part of the program again, the numbers are 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet, 530-413-4515 east of Earth, and 530-413-4520 west of Earth. And we always encourage you to listen live for free. If you want to do that with your cell phone, you can do it by simply dialing 712-432-0075 and then the access code 318-116-pound. This subject we're talking about tonight, the reason behind why all the wild animals have been plunging to their deaths, have been showing up in huge numbers all over the world, and not only falling from the sky, but floating up dead in rivers and on the edge of the ocean. We have, of course, seen whales beaching themselves for a couple of decades, and we don't really know why they do it. Young and old, they just seem to swim ashore and have no orientation about them, show no real interest about going back out to sea. We're not really sure why that happens. And now we have an idea that this magnetic pole is now shifting much, much faster than we originally thought. Now, I know you think, well, gee, maybe we just missed it. Maybe we just didn't pay any attention to it. Maybe nobody really brought it up. Maybe those in mainstream just weren't really watching it. The clip I'm going to play for you now is a Fox News clip, but it has Michio Kaku as one of the commentators. It's an important piece because he reiterates what I just told you, that there is evidence that they have made a mistake. And I want you to pay close attention to this. Here we go.
They could be bigger and more immediate than the threat of global warming, they say. Earth's magnetic field, which acts as our protective shield in space, has a hole in it. And that could put a lot of our earthly functions at risk. Dr. Michio Kaku, professor and author of the book Physics of the Impossible, is back with us. Professor, how are you? And good morning to you.
Glad to be on the show.
Thanks. Twice in 1 week, man. It's bonus hour.
Mm-hmm.
What is this solar shield?
Well, every 11 years, the sun has a temper tantrum. It releases a shockwave, a tsunami of radiation that could wipe out communication, weather satellites, GPS, spy satellites, you name it. It's up there in outer space.
So you're saying that my BlackBerry won't work?
The internet, box, television, cable, satellite, TV, all of it could get wiped out around 2012. That's when we have the peak of the sunspot cycle. That's when the sun's magnetic field flips. North Pole and South Pole flip, releasing a shockwave of radiation, which will then hit the Earth minutes later, potentially wiping out a good chunk of our satellite communications. We're watching it very carefully now.
Well, Doc, this happens how often, you say?
Every 11 years.
Well, However, why an 11-year cycle?
It takes 11 years for the magnetic field of the sun to build up enough intensity to begin the flip process because it slowly revolves in a circle. It's like winding up the windings of a clock. If you wind up the mainspring of a clock too much, it boing, boing, comes out of control. Same thing with the sun's magnetic field. It literally flips every 11 years, releasing a shockwave of radiation. And that means we have to start to think about reinforcing our satellites, building redundant systems, because it means that GPS, the power grid, weather satellites, communication satellites, satellite television, all of that could get disrupted, peaking around 2012.
So your point is we can't do anything about it in space, but we can do something back here on Earth.
That's right.
But backup systems, are companies really doing that?
Well, they're going to have to do it because, see, we scientists made a mistake. We thought that the next cycle was going to be quiet. Well, some of our data was off by a factor of 20, and that's why we're issuing this alert now. We made a mistake. The next cycle, peaking around 2012, will be much more serious than we previously thought. Now, in the past, we dodged the bullet because we didn't have that many satellites up there 11, 22 years ago. Back in 1990, we didn't have that many space satellites.
Well, that makes sense to me. But, you know, I'm listening to you talk. I'm thinking, why 2K? I'm thinking it's just a tactic that put a lot of fear in a lot of people. It may have gotten us ready, but there was really no danger in the end.
Well, let's hope that it's a dud. Let's hope that nothing happens. However, what if? What if our communication systems are wiped out? Billions of economic activity could be jeopardized.
Do you think anyone's taking this seriously?
I think we're going to have to. The physicists are now sounding the alert. We made a mistake. We made the wrong projection. The next solar cycle will be more intense than previously thought. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Now's the time to begin to create redundant systems, reinforce our satellites, build backup systems.
Right. Michio Kaku, the word is out. You know, if you render my BlackBerry useless, that's okay. I'm here loud. Do that for a while, then we'll bring it back. Thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
All right, so there you have it. That's mainstream commentating being done on Fox News Live with Michio Kaku talking about solar winds could damage satellites and power grids. He's talking about the solar magnetic poles flipping. The Earth's magnetic poles also flip from time to time. We don't know exactly how often. We can go by geologic records, and if we think that the Earth is, if the Earth is as old as we say it is, then it's probably true. These things do flip about every 800,000 years, and we're getting pretty close for one. Now, the idea of a solar storm, of course, isn't new. There's also another piece here on Fox News about a solar storm. I'm going to go ahead and play that now because I want you to keep this all in perspective. And then I'm going to play for you the official government response. This is something quite different than what you expect, and I think you're going to be amazed by it. This hour is really going to take off. So hold on. Here we go. This is the Fox News solar storm piece, and we'll cover this.
Everybody, the sun, it's the source of all life, and it could mean the end of life as we know it. NASA did a study, and its findings are now out. We're not talking about global warming. A brand new government study on the very real destructive threat of solar storms. Check it out. The surface of the sun, a roiling mass of plasma and charged high-energy particles. As we move to the launch pad, we can show exactly what we mean, escaping the surface of the sun and traveling through space to areas down here on Earth. Now, this giant fireball, if that ball hit the Earth and its magnetic shield, it would be devastating. I want to show you New York City at night. Times Square, drove through here at 8 o'clock last night. Streets are empty, but the electric power grid would be wiped out by the current. Lights and computers, transportation, hospitals, all would go down. The study warns it would be a disaster, far worse than anything we have seen before. The menace of these sunstorms poses a bigger threat to more high-tech and advanced countries like the U.S. Everything from our sewage systems to our Wall Street banks operate with our power grid. And a game-changing solar storm that could hit at any time. So how worried should we be? Sounds like we should be. Michio Kaku is an astrophysicist and author of The Physics of the Impossible. Sir, good morning to you. Welcome back here.
Glad to be on your show.
Now, what I'm reading here scares me to death. Should I be that way?
That's right. We're talking about a potential Katrina from outer space. Katrina caused about $100 billion in property damage. And unless we begin to make efforts now to reinforce our satellites and power grid, we could have something maybe 10 times bigger than Katrina, because we're talking about the loss of all electricity and all satellite activity. We'd be thrown 100 years back into the past.
Michio, has this happened before?
In 1859, we had a humongous storm that wiped out telegraph poles, and we tried to then estimate what kind of power could do that. And we now realize that we are very young in the space age. If something like the 1859 storm hit again, it would literally paralyze all the United States, not just for a day or an hour, but for months to years. Our transformers would short circuit and burn out. Satellites would be fried to a crisp. And the sun, however, has these storms every 11 years. Every 11 years, the magnetic field flips. But in 2012, we do expect perhaps another big one.
Well, we have never before in our history, in human history for that matter, relied so much on technology as we do today. And that's part of what they found in the study, because we rely so much on our ability to communicate through our computers that they would all go down, which would handicap not just New York, but really the eastern half of the United States. That's what the study finds, which would be far worse than the blackout of New York from 4 years ago, Michio.
That's right. Those blackouts only last for a few hours to a day. But if you start to short circuit all the transformers and blow out the satellites and fry the communications grid, then you're talking about knocking out the United States for months before we can get enough rescue crews and repairmen to handle not just one city, but hundreds of cities around the United States.
You know, Michio, sometimes you come on here and you sound like the doctor of doom and gloom. Does something like this keep you up at night?
It does, and I think with Katrina, you know, engineers knew that Katrina could happen, but they did nothing because they said that it's not going to happen while I'm around. Well, now we learned the lesson. You have to prepare for things, especially when you know that at some point it's inevitable that we're going to have another big one, like we had back in 1859, except this time we're totally dependent on electricity.
Michio, thank you. Hope to see you in person next time. We'll take you on the phone if we can. Michio Kaku, thank you for your time today.
Now, if you go back and look at some of the history of the 1859 solar storm, we really didn't know what we were dealing with there. We had telegraph wire, which was basically heavy copper wire strung along poles, literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles along railroads. And what would happen is we would communicate by sending voltage down the poles, and we had amplifiers along the way. We would boost the voltage to a specific point so that it would operate an electromagnet at the other end, which would attract the tapper on the telegraph and make a clicking sound. Now, the timing between the taps were interpreted as dashes or dots, which was developed by Samuel Morse. The Morse code was the method by which we communicated on the telegraph, and there was some slang that was also used as a method of communicating on the telegraph. But by and large, these were just basically long DC, direct current lines, and we communicated with electromagnetics tapping back and forth. That was the basic communication. When the 1859 flare hit, the protons, the electrons that bathed the Earth from that solar storm, were picked up by that copper wire. Now, workers that were working on the telegraph or with telegraphs at several terminals and even on the poles were electrocuted and were knocked down. Why did that happen? Because along the way, these wires picked up enough electricity, not the normal voltage that would just normally make it uncomfortable for you if you were touching the wires, but would amplify that voltage to the point where it was deadly, or it was at least very, very uncomfortable. Today, we operate with alternating current, AC current. In this country, we operate with 60 cycles per second. And in Europe, they operate with 50 cycles per second. Your computer screens operate with 70 cycles per second. The reason they do that is so that you can stare at the screen for long periods of time without getting a headache. Because although your eyes don't pick up the 60 cycles per second, because your mind cannot interpret that quickly, seeing with your eyes, and we sort of mask it over with phosphorus on the screens. But with today's modern screens and resolutions, we use less and less of that. We use different elements now to produce the light that don't have a residual fluorescence or phosphorescence to keep that value on the screen. We have to raise the frequency with which the flash of the screen occurs so that your eyes don't see the flashing. And that way you don't get a headache. You can stare at it for long periods of time. So we're talking about, you know, still fairly low frequency, but still it's not DC. This is an alternating current. In order to step up and step down that current so that we can use smaller wire, we raise the voltage. The high tension lines that you see out there on the big poles, the big steel ones or the big wooden ones out there, are usually in the area of 161 kilovolts. Yeah, 161,000 volts up there on the aluminum wires that go the long distance, say, from the nuclear power station to a substation. Those voltages are then stepped down by large, what we call auto-tap transformers. Most substations go from 161 kV down to 13.8 kV, 13,800 volts. That's approximately a 12 to 1 turn down. That means that there are 12 times as many windings on, there are 12 windings for every one winding on the primary and secondary side. And what this does is it steps down the voltage and it raises the current. And that allows us to step that down and down and down until finally it reaches your house, single phase, 220 volts. That's what you run your stove on and your air conditioning on and your electric heat if you're lucky enough to have electric heat. My goodness, that would spin the meter off the wall. But those things run on 220 and everything else in your house runs on one or the other leg of the 220 as 110. All your computers and iPod battery chargers and TVs and everything like that runs on 110. That's how it's stepped down. Now, if you take a solar storm and you throw that much energy into the system, it doesn't just get stepped down. It also gets stepped up the other way because the electricity isn't coming from the nuclear power plant. It's coming from the sun. And so now you're talking about not the 100,000 volts that came from the sky and jumped onto the copper wire and knocked telegraph workers off the line. You're talking 100,000 times 12. You're talking 100,000 times 40. Yes. Now you're talking about millions of volts. And you're not talking about low current. You're talking about high current. And what happens is these transformers are power rated. They have internal fuses, yes, but they have heavy copper banding and heavy aluminum banding immersed in oil in order to keep air away from them, and they're insulated, but they're only rated for a certain amount of voltage. Once you exceed that voltage, then you begin jumping between the insulators. You create this short circuit that Michio was talking about. This is why transformers, thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them. Okay, you want to know what the transformers are. I see that in the chat. Okay. Yes, the substations that you drive by, the big powder blue transformers with the big radiators on them. Yes, of course. Those would be fried, absolutely cooked. Even if they could get there in time and disconnect them from the bus bars, Bus bars are the giant switches that connect it to the power grid. Even if they could get there in time to disconnect that, the fact that they would try to transfer electricity internally from coil to coil, they would probably fry anyway. These big ones are not rated for that kind of power. Now, step down a little bit and look at the powder blue ones on the top of your poles outside your homes. These are the ones that take the once step down ones from 4160 and jump it down to what comes into your home if you have elevated wires. And if you're lucky enough to have underground utilities in a more upscale neighborhood, then you've got the little green pad-mounted transformers out in the yard every so often. These take usually 14,400 volts in or 7,200 volts in and turn out the 220 volts that you use for your home or several homes. So these are anywhere up to about 100 kVA, which is a pretty good-sized transformer. These are rated for a certain amount of current. Once the sun throws its electrons onto the grid, and believe me, the wires will just pick it right up, there's no shielding on those wires to prevent them from picking that voltage up. It's going to go on those transformers, and those transformers are going to burn up. 100% guaranteed. Once those transformers burn up, there's no electricity. I don't care if they start the plant back up. There's no way to step down the voltage to get it to your home. There's no way to step down the voltage to get it to the place of business. The transformer is going to be fried. It's not the wires on the poles that are going to fry, although aluminum wire will just explode once it gets to a certain voltage. That's why it's aluminum. They don't want hot, red-hot copper wires falling onto things and burning them up. And it's also really, really, really hard to support copper stretched over a quarter of a mile at a time. So aluminum is a lot easier to support, especially when you put a steel support cable with it. So this is how the power distribution system works in the United States of America, and it's pretty darn modern. You can say what you want about it, but the high power guys, the high tension guys, the co-ops and power companies out there, whether it's Avista or Duke or Southern GE or whatever, they do a pretty good job of going out there and modernizing all the insulators, all the transformers, all the wiring, all the poles that get rotten and need to be replaced. All those things are upgraded, but they're not ready for this. And once the electricity goes down, the factories that make the transformers will also go down. So you can see it will take some time to recover from it. Now, the fact that mainstream scientists are out in the news media now making statements that we made a mistake. You heard Michio say it several times. We made a mistake. That's why we're putting out the alarm now. Our data was off by a factor of 20. Now, that's the mainstream science. You want to hear what the government line is? I just happen to have it. Yes, I happen to have a NASA scientist who has come out in the public and he has given his official NASA scientist public servant GS-12 statement. You will not believe it. After hearing all of this, after seeing the logic in everything that I have just laid out for you in the last hour and a half, that world experts and news reporters have put out for you and historically documented for you, going back to the 1859 solar blast, and the idea that the sun is going through this polar shift every 11 years and that the Earth is about due for its polar shift, and the idea that the poles of the Earth are now moving at a rate of what? 25 miles a year? So fast that airports are now having to start renumbering their airport runways to line up with their actual reading on the magnetic compass? All right, let's listen to a NASA scientist speaking the real truth about the year 2012. Here we go.
Hi, my name is David Morrison. I'm a space scientist at NASA Ames Research Center. For the last 2 years, I've been answering hundreds of questions from the public about 2012 and the supposed threat to Earth. And so now I want to take a chance to talk to some of you more directly. There is no threat to Earth in 2012. There is no danger. All of the talk about a doomsday is a big hoax perpetuated on the internet and with people trying to make money So please don't worry about it. Let me talk about some of the specific things. There's been a lot of talk about a Planet X or Nibiru as a giant planet that's going to hit the Earth or at least come very close in December 2012. Simple fact is Nibiru does not exist. Aside from worrying about the weird places the ideas came from, all you have to do is ask the astronomers, if Nibiru or Planet X were going to come into the inner solar system in 2012, astronomers would have been tracking it for the last decade, all over the world, amateur as well as professional, and it would be visible now to the naked eye. It's not there. It's a no-show. There's nothing to worry about some object coming and striking the Earth or damaging us. There's also been concern about a so-called galactic alignment, because in December of every year, the Sun is roughly in the direction of the galactic center as seen from Earth. This happens every year. It really doesn't mean anything, and there's nothing special about 2012. If you're not worried about December 29, don't worry about December 2012. In fact, alignments, although it may sound scary to some people, are just not an issue for scientists. There are no special forces when planets align or the Sun aligns. It's sort of a curiosity, but not something of real scientific interest. There's also been concern that somehow the Earth's poles are going to flip. No one quite explains how this could happen, and if you're talking about the rotation pole of the Earth, that can't change. It never has and never will. Some people, however, are concerned about the change in the magnetic polarity, a shift of the North and South Pole, which does take place every few hundred thousand years. But there's no reason to think it will happen in 2012, and actually no evidence that it would do any harm to us, even if it did happen. Some people couple this with ideas of solar outbursts, of flares, or coronal mass ejections, which could do great damage to the Earth. Well, the solar maximum takes place every 11 years, and occasionally there is some damage to satellites in orbit. And we see bright aurora or northern lights here, but very little real damage is done. And there's no solar maximum predicted in 2012. The next solar maximum is predicted for the spring of 2013, and it's actually anticipated that it will be much lower than usual. Again, all this 2012 talk is just a hoax. It's a fake. It's nothing you should worry about. I get questions from many people who are really scared, even some young people who have said they're contemplating suicide, this sort of thing. It's really sad. And the point of my talking to you now is just to explain to you that there is no problem there. And that the many things you see on the internet and YouTube where people claim that there is some horrible threat about to descend on us are not true. Don't worry about 2012 and enjoy 2013 when it comes.
Well, gee, I feel so much safer now that David Morrison has given us that official statement. Now, is there something to this story, possibly? Because maybe because we have empowered tens of millions of people to the future events, that we can now manifest something else? You notice that both Michio and this NASA scientist are speaking of the same galactic alignment, by the way. This is the one with the Sun and the galactic center. This is not the alignment that we are mentioning in our research. This is not the alignment that the ancients were worried about. It's not even the one that the Babylonians described, that the Maya described. It's not the one the Egyptians talked about. The regular alignment of the Sun, the Earth, and the center of the galaxy is as ordinary as rain. However, the alignment of the solar system and the rift in the Milky Way at the galactic plane is significant. We are talking about a plane, a flat plane of more intense gravitational energy, where there is a node that is a peak of what only recently has been termed dark matter exists. It is this band of matter through which the solar system travels every 25,000 years as it goes through the precession of the equinoxes. Neither Michio nor Mr. Morrison mentioned that alignment. It's because maybe they didn't want to, or because they didn't know enough about it, and many speculate it's because they don't want to say anything about it. Now, we may be a year or two off, as we have had real dating washed out by dozens of religious calendars, but there is a consensus that we are close, very close, to the node of higher energy particles that can wreak havoc with electronic gear. It can and does wreak havoc with physiology and biological systems. Animals are flying into the dirt. People are having anxiety. They're having visions. They are receiving information and inspiration to about which they are writing, about which they are painting, about which they are composing songs, and about which they express great emotional reaction. To class the internet together as wholly unreliable and only the sources at the university level as reliable is also a very risky path down the road of folly. Affiliated science, that is to say, science that is related to universities, is notoriously plagued with mistakes and follies. The retraction and correction of theories happens now almost monthly, as discoveries are happening at an accelerated rate. How is that happening? The internet. That's how. Thousands of papers are being issued every day that are moving human awareness forward like a nitromethanol-fueled dragster. The peer-reviewed affiliated pathway for publication is far too slow, and it reaches only a fraction of the people who need to read those papers. Contrary to popular academic belief, there are smart people who do not attend college. It comes as a devastating blow to the academic world that intelligent people can learn on their own without the incense and blessings of the high priests of academia. The value of a degree is still important, but less and less is it the baptismal record of intelligence. Believe me, some of the stupidest people I have ever met were PhDs. Somehow, they made it through the requirements and got the diploma, but they are dumb as a bag of rocks. So do you feel safer that NASA scientist David Morrison has no doubts and has been blessed all the way from high school into the ranks of public servitude, who claims that everything is all right and there is nothing to fear from 2012. Do you really think that the extremes in weather, magnetic physiological failures, and even extraplanetary forces that we have seen radically change in the last 20 years are just nothing to be concerned about? They're just ordinary? It's interesting that we see this. Now, if we were to believe David Morrison, and that there is nothing to worry about, this is the official NASA story. He has been spending 20 years speaking to all kinds of people and all kinds of events, probably NASA-sponsored events, that there's nothing to fear. Everything is under control. Everything has been figured out by a team of experts specially trained in that area, and everything is okay. Well, I got news for you. because that's what we do right here at X Squared Radio. Follow the money. Follow the money. If there's nothing to worry about, then the government wouldn't be spending any money chasing it, would they? The government wouldn't have launched the Themis probes in 2007 to study the source of the Aurora Borealis. The government wouldn't be launching satellites with higher resolution in all kinds of bandwidths, magnetic, infrared, ultraviolet, and visible, in order to study not space, but the Earth. The government wouldn't be spending money in preparing itself, hardening things, and getting ready for this massive solar flare, quick disconnect systems, so that as soon as the flare is noticed coming from the sun, picked up by the Solar Dynamics Observatory, we can start disconnecting circuits here on the Earth and try to save them from this blast of electrons and protons coming from the sun. The government wouldn't be spending money on a way to preserve itself as a body, as a company, as a group of elite. They wouldn't be spending our money to do that. Not if there was nothing to worry about. They wouldn't be moving the nation's most vital records and processors to hardened areas like Denver, Colorado, or NORAD. They wouldn't be building underground bases or anything like that, would they, if there was nothing to worry about? I have another clip. This one comes from a live report deep inside an underground base. This is real. This guy is there, and he's talking about it.
Hey, this is Eric. I'm in a deep underground cave system for our nation's food storage and our well-being, I guess. It's a central locality. Undisclosed location. I'm going to give you a view of it live on my side, breaking. So you guys won't usually get to see this stuff, but this is a deep underground military base system. Reminds me of what I used to work at as a Marine. Dumps Forces, Security Forces, Fleet Marine Force, FMF. Here you go.
What we're looking at is a very high ceiling cave system.
Let me show you the size of this cave. Here goes this truck.
This is a 53-foot semi.
Picking up stuff. And there's my beautiful Big Ben right there.
That's a Kenworth. Yeah, it is a Kenworth with a 53-foot trailer behind it.
Caves.
Ceilings are about 40 feet high.
Pretty damn cool, huh? Yeah. So, if we got this stuff, like I say, if we got this stuff on this kind of security level, which is pretty minute, think what they got. Unlike, you know, top security levels. Heavy duty, folks.
So there you go. That's a live report from inside of a underground base. And there were semi-trucks unloading stuff, 53-foot trailers hooking up to the loading docks. This has a polished concrete floor. There is not a bit of dirt or gravel on the ground. This is carved out of solid rock. According to the fence sign here, it's 2,600 feet underneath the ground. And I guess I would ask the question, what's going on? How much money has been stolen from the public? And why would anyone in authority take such a risk, obviously without long-term returns on investment? Why would they take such a risk with the taxpayers' money because there is no long term to consider. That's why. And that's what is the real thrust behind this. Now you see what's going on. Now, you want to know how much money has disappeared. It is absolutely mind-boggling how much money we're talking about. We're not talking about billions of dollars. That is peanuts. The money that you have paid in as taxpayers has been taken from you on a scale that would boggle even the Romans, ancient Romans' minds. How much money has been taken from the taxpayers of the world, not just the taxpayers of the United States? Oh, that goes without saying. And it's not just money taken from your paycheck. Okay? This is money that is taken from your paycheck before you ever even earn the money, because the Federal Reserve prints this money out of nothing. They create this cash by just adding zeros to the bank. There's nothing backing it at all. And yet they pay for supplies, for equipment, and for the construction of these huge facilities underground. And why would they be building them underground with isolated power systems hardened against what? Hardened against what the NASA scientists told us exactly was not going to happen. If it wasn't going to happen, and the government was sure that it wasn't going to happen, then they would not be spending this kind of money to get themselves ready for it happening. In the meantime, there is no public service announcement to help you get ready for it. There's no funding to help you protect yourself. That's why we here at X Squared Radio have been telling you now for a couple of years. Now we've got a great affiliate, but we want you to go out and get emergency preparedness supplies for yourself. Imagine, just try it one weekend. Go out on a Friday night and shut off the main breaker to your house and see what you're ready to do by Sunday night. See what your kids are ready to do by Sunday night. Why don't you practice it? All right, let's talk about how much missing money we're talking about here.
When the media announced the Paulson Bernanke plan to bail out Wall Street by giving the Treasury $700 billion and carte blanche to do whatever they want with it, people got angry.
You're talking about a bailout for like some of the wealthiest banks in the world, but yet we can't seem to help our own citizens who are having foreclosure crises.
No deal for Wall Street! No deal for Main Street! Main first! Main Street first!
But if people are upset over this proposed $700 billion plan, why are they not equally upset by the $188 billion per day that was actually created by the Federal Reserve last week alone to help prop up the failing investment banks? Or the $630 billion the Fed pledged to inject into the system as soon as the bailout was rejected?
By the way, I want to put this in perspective. This happened within the last 6 months. Within the last 6 months. This happened from last summer until now. Okay, just a couple more minutes and then we'll get to the phones. Okay, hold on. Just hold on. Here we go.
The fact is that in the last week alone, more than $1.5 trillion have been made available in sweetheart loans to Wall Street by the Federal Reserve.
Now, by Wall Street, I want to be clear on this. We're not talking about Goldman Sachs and companies like that, not investment firms. We're talking about real companies that didn't need the money, like General Electric, like Disney. They didn't need the money, but the interest rate was so low that they couldn't resist. So let's go ahead and take the phone call and put this into perspective. Robin from North Carolina, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I got a question to ask you.
Okay.
When you're talking about the money that they, are you talking about the money that they should have been putting into the infrastructure here for these kind, you know, for a catastrophe like Michikaka was talking about?
No, what we're talking about is money that was originally created for the bailout that was paid out and then paid back. Now, there was somewhere around $3.3 trillion as we total this all up. It should have been used to pay down the U.S. debt, which is about $14 trillion. This is what Congress wanted to do with it. But at the very time that Congress was beginning to debate the bills that would put this money against the U.S. debt and pay out the American people from this long-term debt that our predecessors have put us into, the Fed took that money without congressional approval and gave it away to these corporate companies. Now, they said it was to support the credit market, but these were companies that don't have any debt. These were companies that didn't need the money. They weren't in trouble. GE and Disney and other companies like that were in great financial shape. They didn't need the money, but they got it because the Fed wanted to give it away.
Well, I'm just wondering, since they have that kind of freedom to do that at any time, is there anything in play? I mean, are there any red flags now that are being thrown down so that they will stop this? Or, I mean, are you hearing anything from the politicians? Or
well, now I spoke to Congressman Dennis Kucinich about this very thing, face-to-face just a couple of months ago in Washington, and here's what he told me, and kind of sheepishly, I have to admit. He said, the banks are always two steps ahead of us. We try to put regulations in place that will make it easy for the banks to do the right thing and meet the credit needs of their community. That's what you heard these protesters talking about on the streets. And they refuse to do it. They work around it faster than Congress can keep up with it. And so the brokers that are inside the banking systems are taking bonuses of $50, $100, $200 million bonuses for one or two or three people. Unbelievable windfall profits at the expense of the American taxpayer.
Are these just the major banks we're talking about, not the locally owned banks?
That's correct. These are banks like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Wachovia, Fifth Third Bank. These are banks that negotiated. They got the bailout money. They were able to fix their problems, and most of them paid the money back. The government got the money back, and instead of turning it back in, because they borrowed it from the American people, and pay off the federal debt, the U.S. debt, they took that money and lent it right out again to high-risk markets overseas.
So the Dennis Kucinich, then his argument is probably false, because when the banks paid it back, right, he also and his constituents voted to turn the money around and give it overseas, right?
Actually, that's not what happened. They never got a chance to vote on it. They were still debating it. And there were people that wanted to do things with that money. Now, the conservatives, they wanted to pay off the debt. The liberals, they wanted to, hey, look, we got all this money. Look at all the good we can do with it. Those arguments hadn't even hit the floor yet. Those bills were still in committee. None of it got voted on. The Federal Reserve acted autonomously and without authority and did it on their own. The Fed chairman doesn't work for Congress.
Okay, so then what we need to do is have Congress get rid of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Well, you know, that's been tried many times. When this country was founded, Some of the founders wanted a national bank, like Alexander Hamilton. He made a great case for it. The country was broke. We were at war. We had a lot of things that we needed money for, not the least of which was river infrastructure, port infrastructure. We needed an army. We didn't have the ability to do it. So Hamilton argued, and I might add very eloquently and very effectively, for a national bank. Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were absolutely opposed to a federal bank. And so now you only have private banks. You have no federal bank. And the Federal Reserve is a group of private banks. They are in business to make money, not to serve the credit needs of the American people.
So all banks in the United States are part of the Federal Reserve. Is that correct? Or are there some banks that are not?
Most banks are not. There are only about 12 member banks of the Federal Reserve.
Oh, you mean so like it's Bank of America and Wells Fargo and all the major banks like that are part of the Federal Reserve?
There is a network often called the Top 20. Fifth Third got its name from the fifth largest bank merging with the third largest bank. They couldn't come up with a name that made sense, so they just called themselves Fifth Third Bank. They are now one of the top five banks in the country.
Okay. So if I'm just thinking as an individual or as, you know, people, the individual people like me, so if we all took our money out of, let's say, our banks like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Fifth Third Bank, et cetera, et cetera, and then we found local banks that are not part of the Federal Reserve, and we put our money in there, then we would essentially be kind of strangling the Federal Reserve and its ability to do things, right?
Theoretically, you're right, but that is not the trend. In fact, often when I go and interview people about this very subject, they want to pull their money from the local banks and move it to the larger banks because there's a better sense of security. And, of course, after they answer the question, then I come back to them and say, you know, you realize that exactly the opposite is true, that your local bank has a local board with local residents that are on that board. And usually those are businessmen that own a significant portion of the assets in the area that the bank is, whether they have 10 branches or 50 branches. And they're actually a lot more secure than the larger interstate and even global banks like Chase and Morgan and China Bank, all of these. In fact, China Bank is so cash heavy right now that they're scooping up American banks as fast as they can find them for sale.
Oh, so, okay. So that kind of makes it, how do you find a local bank then, and that's not going to be vulnerable to China scooping it up?
That's a great question. One of the things to look for is whether the bank sells their paper or not. If you get a home loan with a bank, ask them as you apply for the loan, do you sell your loans? And if they say no, we keep all our loans in-house. That's the bank you want to do business with. Most Americans, especially if they make their payments on time, if they've owned that home for 10 years or more, chances are they have made their mortgage payments to at least 3 to 5 different banks.
Okay, so what you need to do is just go to your little town and find your little local town bank, right? Or I don't know where you'd find a local bank in like someplace like New York City, but I guess there's probably local banks there, right?
Yeah, I would say there's probably a couple thousand bank charters in New York City. Just about every town has several bank charters in it.
And then, get a checking account and savings account and your charge account there. I don't know that I'd probably remortgage my house and try to get a loan through them since I've already got a good deal, but I could probably just start a savings account there and everything at this my local bank.
Yeah, I mean, if you've had your home loan longer than 5 years, you're starting to pay principal now. So you don't want to refinance and start the clock all over again, unless you're going to get a 15-year mortgage and, you know, you've paid off 10 years of a 30-year mortgage, then that might make sense because you could pull some cash out of your house and do some advanced things that you want to do either to the home or for your kids in college or whatever like that. But those of you that are considering new home loans, it's pretty difficult to get a home loan from a local bank because guess who they have to borrow the money from? They have to borrow the money from the Fed. And, of course, they pay a certain a percentage on that, which they pass along to you with a small markup, and that's how they make part of their money. Now, don't think for a moment that they borrow the money for 4%, loan it to you for 6%, that they're making 2% of that money. That's not true. They're making about 24% on the money. Why? Because it wasn't their money to begin with. They're not loaning their money. They're loaning someone else's money, which is an asset.
So, what you're saying is you really don't want to go to the local bank and get a home loan because you'd be helping the Federal Reserve. So what you want to do is just use it as a savings, maybe do your 401ks there, some of your financial, you know, get a good financial advisor, those kind of accounts.
And by all means, go to the annual shareholders meeting at the bank. Buy some stock in the bank and become part of the bank. Become part of your community.
Let's just do a hypothetical. So if everybody in the United States went to their local bank tomorrow, okay, every average American, and decided to pull their money from the major banks and into their local bank that's not Federal Reserve, what do you think the impact would be?
Well, for one thing, I would probably be put in jail for advocating it here on a public radio program. There are people that just Twitter people to get their money out of a certain bank, and they go to jail. It is against the law to publicly advocate a run on the banks.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying what if, hypothetically, everybody decided to. I'm not telling everybody to do it, but what do you think the ramifications would be if everybody did that?
Well,
I'm not saying you're saying they can do that. I'm just saying what would happen.
Very large companies have gone under in a very short amount of time because they're running on very small margins from that very action. There was a company called MCI WorldCom that was the biggest around in the telecom industry back in the early 90s. And because they ripped off so many customers and because consumers went to the trade commissions of their various states and various states sued MCI WorldCom for confiscatory telecom practices and billing practices, they went out of business. So, yes, it is possible to take down billion-dollar corporations with the public advocacy. Absolutely.
Well, I'm just curious because now let's say that happened. Would our government get in on the act and try to bail them out again with our tax dollars?
Yes,
they
would.
I mean, it's kind of a vicious cycle.
Well, yes, they would. And there's this idea that certain organizations are too big to fail, like General Motors is too big to fail. I don't agree. I think that the good parts of General Motors would have survived. I think the good parts of Wachovia would have survived. I think the good parts of a Bank of America would have survived because there are other banks like Wells Fargo that were plenty cash heavy that could have moved in just like they did with Wachovia and acquire their good parts and keep them going. Their depositors never lost a penny. That being said, you've got Wells Fargo and you have a Bank of America that are on a freight train, absolute full bore freight train, doing foreclosures as fast as their team of attorneys can process them.
Okay. Well, that's all I had to say. I just was curious what your thoughts were on that. It's kind of interesting.
Well, I knew we were going to get off on a tangent. What I wanted to make the case of is if NASA is saying, look, there's nothing to be worried about. Okay, this happens every year. It's just another Y2K, you know, money thing. It's don't worry about it. It's just nuts on the internet talking about it. Nobody's paying any attention to this. I'm saying, and these audio clips are saying, that is hooey. Because there are not billions of dollars, there are trillions of dollars being spent making underground shelters for who? For you? For me? I don't think so. I didn't get my invitation. It's not for us. It's for them. And it's our money that's being used for it. That's the case that I was trying to make.
Wouldn't it be better just to do what Michio Kaku said and back up the infrastructure and the systems so that, you know, and reinforce them so it isn't a big issue? You know, put in better and insulated satellites up there, insulate the transformers better. Couldn't you just, if you knew there was like a something like that coming, like a solar blast coming like that, flare, couldn't you just shut down the systems?
Yeah,
and turn them back on once the danger's over, where it wouldn't impact them, or yeah. Would it impact them?
We'll have anywhere from 10 to 70 hours of warning that this is coming. So yes, the power grids can go offline. They can disconnect bus bars. They can take precautions on the big transformers and make sure that they survive. But the idea that there is a belief that maybe they won't survive and these groups want to survive, I think is fine. Let them raise their own money to do it, or let them make the shelters available to everybody if it's so needed. If there's going to be some conflagration of the surface of the earth by these, you know, like the movie Knowing, then they need to make those shelters available for everyone deep beneath the earth and in solid rock. So far, we haven't been told about it. I don't even know where they are. I don't even know where that guy was with his semi that did that live report. But we do know that they're being built, which means everything that NASA guy just told us is not true.
Yeah, well, I guess my point here was that it would stand to reason that the people, you know, obviously in charge of the power grids and stuff like that, the electric companies, they would be looking at those reports, because we can get them now. They would have announcements where they'll be, because they have brownouts and stuff like that, where they were alternating and turning off power in certain parts of California and New York during really hot periods in the summer and a few years back when the power grid couldn't handle it. Couldn't they just, you know, tell them that, you know, we're going through a cycle, it's really unusual, we may be without power, it's not going to be like a snowstorm or ice storm that's going to shut us down where you're going to be walking around in it and you can, you know, see and feel it, but it'll be a solar flare blast that is just as damaging, and we're just going to shut it down until this passes, you know, for maybe it's 48 hours or whatever, and then the power will resume. And actually just, I guess, have somebody hire people at the different power companies to be watching for this and set up alert systems within them.
That sounds reasonable to me. Why don't you run for office and make it happen? I think it'd be a capital idea.
I mean, you don't have to have underground shelters or anything else. You just, you know, I mean, cities have been without power for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. Major cities like the one I lived in was, you know, 5 years back was without power in the middle of winter for 4.5 days.
Yep.
I mean, millions of people were without power. Now it is uncomfortable, and it is, you know, you do have to kind of do.
With it like this, we're talking about 5 to 20 years of being without power. That's what Michio was saying about knocking us back 100 years. Let me go ahead and finish out this hour. I completely thank you so much for the phone call. It's been terrifically interesting, and I always like it when you call. So thank you very much.
Thanks for taking the call. Thank you.
My pleasure. All right, let's go ahead and finish the rest of this clip. It's not very long, just a couple of minutes, and then we'll finish out this hour.
America's Central Bank.
The name Federal Reserve conjures a reassuring image of a federally operated bank lending out its physical reserves. But there are just two problems with that perception.
Oh, absolutely. The Federal Reserve is neither federal and has doubtful reserves.
What is little understood, even by Congress, is that when the Fed makes these loans, it is not lending out actual money from its physical reserves. It is, in fact, using its bank charter to create money out of thin air. The problem with this system is that when money is created out of nothing, it increases the money supply without any corresponding increase in the economy. More paper chasing the same amount of goods means each dollar is worth less. This is inflation. The effect is the exact same as if the Federal Reserve went into your bank account and took a percentage of your savings. Ron Paul explains.
But I maintain really that inflation is a tax, and if the Federal Reserve and you as chairman have this authority to increase the money supply arbitrarily, you're probably the biggest taxer in the country. You're a bigger taxer than the Congress. Because, you know, they're talking now about a bailout package of $300 billion, and we'll have to raise the national debt to accommodate to take care of the housing crisis. But you as a Federal Reserve chairman and the Federal Reserve board and the system create hundreds of billions of dollars without even appropriation process.
Congressman, I couldn't agree with you more that inflation is a tax.
In other words, when the Federal Reserve injects this money onto Wall Street to prop up the investment banks, they are taxing you to bail out the bankers. And if people are upset about this $700 billion proposed bailout, why aren't they upset about the $2.3 trillion that the Pentagon blithely admits has gone missing from their coffers?
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Oh, and the date of that announcement? September 10th, 2001. And one of the offices destroyed in the attack on the Pentagon the very next day? The budget analyst office.
I want to make sure that you didn't just glaze over that, okay? That was September 10th, 2001, when the revelation that $300 million was missing and could not be accounted for during congressional hearings. And the very next day, something... I know we're darn sure it wasn't an airplane, hit the Pentagon budget office where the records were kept. You know, hey, we can't tell you where the money went because, we had a fire. Well, I can tell you definitively, after looking at all the evidence, no airplane, no terrorist airplane hit the Pentagon, period. End of sentence. I don't know about anything else. I don't know about the Trade Center because I kind of watched that on the news, but I didn't watch the Pentagon one on the news except after the fact. But I can tell you that nice, pretty green lawn right in front of the Pentagon didn't have a single shred of aircraft wreckage on it. There were no wheels, no brakes, no titanium compressor blades, which are not flammable. There was nothing. No seatbelts, no human remains, no fuel, no nothing at the Pentagon. A nice, neat, round hole right in the P.O. box of the budget office. Let's continue.
That plane had come directly under our section of the offices, the Army Budget Office, where 38 Army employees were killed, was directly beneath us.
But surely we can trust that this $2.3 trillion is insignificant and that Rumsfeld was justified in brushing off questions from Congress about the matter.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook.
I've forgotten what the second question was.
That's Donald Rumsfeld.
I think Ms. Jonas knows it.
Okay.
But if people aren't concerned about the hidden Federal Reserve inflation tax or the trillions missing from the Pentagon, perhaps this number will give them pause for thought. 1 quadrillion. That's the amount held globally in derivatives, exotic financial instruments that exploded in popularity in recent years. Derivatives are essentially financial fictions, imaginary wealth created by leveraging out real assets hundreds of times. This means that a small amount of assets can represent mind-boggling amounts of money on the balance books of most major investment banks. Now, the meltdown in mortgage-backed securities is threatening to start a chain reaction, burning its way through this derivative bubble.
Now, I want to let you know what a mortgage-backed security is. Those of you that have never taken your Series 7 license might not know what that is. When you go get an FHA loan, let's say you buy a $120,000 house, you go through the FHA process, and your FHA loan is underwritten by an underwriter. They look at your phone bills and your light bills and your student loans and how well you've paid your bills and what kind of money you make and how long you've been on the job and blah, 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 all of that. They dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and they form an FHA loan package, approve for you a loan. Then they put your loan package, your $120,000 loan, together with enough loans to make a $5 million approximately block of loans. That $5 million block of loans has all the folders with all of the documentation from all of your loans, which have been underwritten by trained and licensed underwriters as a package. That is now a $5 million mortgage-backed security. It's just like a stock certificate, except that it's backed by your credit. It's backed by your ability to pay and all the other people that are inside of your mortgage-backed security package. You package all of those together, neighborhood by neighborhood, city by city, county by county, state by state, and that is what they're using as the backing for this money. Now, as long as you make your payments, which you're likely to do if you keep your job, then those mortgage-backed securities are good things to bank on. Why? Because they're backed by real estate. First mortgage real estate, usually 85% loan-to-value or better. Now you get the picture. Two things happen. You lose your job, and lots of people in your neighborhood lose their jobs, and a bunch of houses get thrown on the market, and guess what happens to the value of your homes? It drops. Which means what backs the mortgage-backed securities, two things, your ability to pay and the equity in your home, the value of your home, both dropped out the bottom, which means that mortgage-backed security is now not worth what it was worth. And that's why the banking system failed. However, it wasn't the cause, it was the effect. Let's continue.
And creating a financial black hole. To put this in perspective, the combined value of all the assets on Earth is estimated to be $100 trillion. That means the entire Earth could be swallowed 10 times over by this financial black hole. So if we're upset over the $700 billion plan, why aren't we concerned about the trillions plundered by the Fed, the trillions missing from the Pentagon, or the quadrillion-dollar derivative bubble? Could it be because the controlled corporate media is trying to distract us from the real issues by telling us we've already won the fight?
That the bill would pass. Well, they knew, and everyone was very careful and very diligent to say that they knew this was going to be a tough vote. It's a tough vote to vote for because you're talking about a potential price tag of $700 billion, no matter what party you stand with.
So now you get the idea. That is how broad and how big and how wide this picture is. It sounds like a solar tsunami, doesn't it? And indeed it does. We'll be back after this break. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming after this.
I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from Mississippi tonight. Down here doing a contract for a large corporation. Can't tell you the name. We're happy to come to you live every Sunday evening between 8 and 11 Eastern Time, 5 and 8 Pacific, right here on xsquaredradio.com on the PBS Radio Network. And you can always listen live for free. That's never a problem here. If you missed the first hour, and believe me, you missed a really good buildup, because we're going to make a beep here real quick. What we were talking about was the incredible occurrences of animals dying all over the world because, well, we don't really know why. They speculated that it might be disease. They speculated fireworks. They speculated, oh, it was high-altitude winds. They have ruled all of those out because this is happening all over the planet. It's happening cross species. It's happening with birds, with crabs, with fish. We've seen it happen with whales over the last few years. The important thing is that they probably have a common source. So we had to go extraplanetary in order to verify this, and we found several studies on the rapidly changing Earth magnetic field. And by changing, I mean it's changing in intensity, and it's also changing in direction. The actual focus of the North Magnetic Pole is changing a stunning 25 miles per year. This is well beyond what anybody suspected. And so this led one thing to another, talking about this expert, that expert. We had Michio Kaku making statements on Fox News. And then we brought David Morrison on with NASA, who said, look, there's nothing to worry about. Everything's under control. Nobody pays any attention to this. And then we got into the fact that if nobody's paying any attention to it, why did we just spend $2.3 trillion on these mysterious programs related to defense, which we have no idea what they're about? So let's go to the phones and see if we can get some more answers. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. I had a question about Nibiru or Nibiru or however it can be pronounced. From a scientific perspective, is it possible for a planet to be out there, perhaps orbiting in a perpendicular plane or a diagonal plane to the plane where most of our planets orbit upon? Is it possible that its orbit is so wide that that it is invisible, or perhaps hasn't been spotted yet, or something along those lines?
Well, I like the word possible. I like the word possibilities. That's something that that physicists can always swallow. I did pick up on what David Morrison said, that surely astronomers would have picked it up by now. We haven't seen anything, so therefore it isn't there. You know, we're not looking for a star. We're looking for a planet. We have a hard time looking for planets. Up until just recently, we'd only found a half a dozen or so because we didn't have a good method for doing so. Now we began, before we put the Kepler mission out there, we began by using what's called perturbation methods, which is we watch the wobble of a star and we calculate based on the amplitude and frequency of that wobble as to how large the planet is that's tugging on that sun as it's going around and around. And sometimes we're really lucky. We can catch the planet going across the face of that star. It drops the sunlight actually being put out by that star. We can calculate the difference, and we get a great measurement on how that what the diameter of that planet is because it's blocking the starlight. However, when you're talking about a free-floating planet, or you're talking about a planet that's not revolving around that sun, but is revolving around our sun, now you're talking a different story. It is possible that there is a planet out there that astronomers have not detected because it is not putting off, it's not reflecting light in our direction. It could be reflecting light in another direction, but not our direction. Got to remember that we're looking at everything that's out there in space from Earth's perspective. So, of course, Nibiru could be out there, and it could be approaching us from one of the poles, north or south. If it's approaching us from the north, we're pretty much hosed because we don't even have astronomical observation abilities from the North Pole like we do the South Pole. Antarctica has a huge complex with wonderful observatories on the South Pole. But if it's approaching us from the north in a perpendicular orbit like you're saying, non-planar, it absolutely could sneak up on us.
Did Sitchin, from his work, in short, does it look like he was saying that it would collide or pass by closely, or was there an implication that the planet could or was on a collision course?
What Sitchin talked about, And believe me, he was backed up also by Emmanuel Velikovsky in his work, Worlds in Collision, is that Nibiru, or a planet like Nibiru, somewhat by that name, has already passed one time by Earth and had cataclysmic effects on our solar system, a la the asteroid belt and all the fracture marks on Mars and the fact that its atmosphere was stripped off of it. The fact that Earth is showing a tremendous rift in our Atlantic crust, which we call the Mindanao Trench, which was obviously done by some interplanetary collision. That could have been the event that ended dinosaurs. It's hard to say. There's a lot of evidence that something very large struck the ocean or became the ocean by striking the Earth in that region. So both sources, the Sumerian texts that Sitchin translated and Emmanuel Velikovsky's work, say that there is historic proof that a planet like Nibiru had a catastrophic effect on the solar system and may return again. That's what the Babylonian scrolls also testify to.
And the asteroid belt in and of itself is a mystery that we could talk about, too, in that from looking at a map of the asteroid belt, it looks like there are clusters of larger masses together on one side orbiting around the sun, whereas there are bits and pieces along, like perhaps the larger, if you were to look at it like a clock, perhaps from 12 until 2 o'clock, there are two larger pieces, and then it seems like they're more scattered about pieces from 2 all the way around to 11 o'clock, where it seems like, at least that was the last map that I was looking at in one of the astronomy magazines. My memory may have left out a few things, but have they been talking much about that having been a planet at one time?
Yeah, there is some papers out there about that, actually, that the asteroid belt does exist on one of the harmonic orbits that would normally carry a planet that would orbit our sun. The fact that the chemical or geological makeup of those asteroids is pretty uniform. It's not a bunch of scattered junk that's been collected over billions of years from various space rocks coming in and joining that orbit. It pretty much had the same origin. And the other idea is that if a large body like Nibiru came through and got close enough to that planet to get inside the Roche limit, that would overcome its own internal gravitational field, and it would simply come apart on its own, and it would not be able to keep itself together. So that is probably why we don't see evidence on the debris itself of a conflagration. In other words, the pieces of rock are pretty frozen, just kind of come apart kind of rocks, except for the very, very slow rotating ones. They're half coated black and the other half is white. It does seem to indicate that it was some gravitational event instead of some absolute collision that just smacked them apart. But anyway, Scott may call back in. He had maybe a little bit of distortion on his line. We'll get it back in where it's nice and clean. The question is that we have a lot of gravitational events that are happening, and we're beginning to pick them up. We're sensing them with various satellites. We're putting even more sensitive satellites out there. And we're also realizing that it's not just orbital gravity that we're worrying about. And by orbital gravity, I mean, look, we're 93 million miles away from the sun. We revolve in approximately 365.25 days around the sun. Those kinds of things, that's orbital gravity. There's also torsional gravity that can stretch hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of miles across space and tie two bodies together. Now we're calling them magnetic ropes. So it's interesting how we're now beginning to discover this, because we're putting the right instruments in space, although it's not happening fast enough for me. Okay, I think we have Scott back now. Welcome back.
Yes, and the two planets beyond Pluto that they recently discovered, that was over the past decade, was it not, where all of a sudden we have two new members of the solar system, which was probably part of Pluto's demotion from planet to planetoid. Correct me if I'm wrong, because the other planets are about the same size as Pluto, and Pluto being smaller than Mercury, and et cetera, et cetera.
That was part of it. The other part of it was that Pluto was discovered to be hollow, and the article, along with your other assertions.
Okay. And just as it took so long to find those planets beyond Pluto, then it would be even less likely because, you know, one would have to be looking in a particular direction to find something like Nibiru, and then it's not going to come by with a name on it either. I mean, it's not going to say, hello, I'm Nibiru, and so on and so forth. I mean, how would we how would we know? It would be the first time in our recorded history where the event would happen.
Oh, exactly right. And you know, this is where the scientists' minds are right now. And there's no consensus. I don't even think there are very strong groups inside the scientific community to make definitive statements about it. The data is coming in so fast from so many different areas that we can't build experiments to launch into space. We're now losing the space shuttle fleet to keep up with the what if.
And I think they were looking in a particular place to find the planets beyond Pluto. They were looking on our plane, and they found them. Whereas, you know, if you start looking in areas beyond, and who knows, maybe the orbit of Nibiru goes way beyond Pluto.
Well, it could if we're talking about that torsional gravity, folks. We are suffering a terrible storm right now down here in Mississippi, so we're going to disconnect and reconnect and see if we can't get a better Skype connection. All right, let's see if that's a little bit better. Hopefully my producer is going to text me and say that sounds a whole lot better. All right, we're live. There we go. See, that doesn't take long. Don't you love internet radio? You get all the bloopers live. So where were we? We were talking about these long-distance gravitational effects. We might not even really be able to call it gravity. You know, we talk about the four forces of the universe, gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak molecular forces. When we go through different dimensions, gravity doesn't really go along with it. The other three forces do. But gravity is kind of a macro kind of force. However, it weakens at the square of the distance. So how much long-range effect really does it have on the universe?
And with us moving into other higher dimensions, imagination, creativity, and energy, from what I've gathered being three of them, then I suppose things can be created on an exponential level from a higher place. If one enters a dimension of creativity where every thought you think automatically is created, or the first thing you imagine is automatically made present to you, or there, and if you enter into an energy dimension where where energy exists, where one could be healed instantaneously as a result of being in a high flux of energy. I mean, we're talking about moving into a whole different paradigm. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I think you're probably right there. I have a feeling that as we change dimensions, things become I don't know if they're going to become more out of touch, but I believe that everything that we think about, everything that we try to manifest, does automatically come true. I just don't think it happens right now because we're able to slow time down. We're able to create perspective with human consciousness. We don't really have a concept, we don't really have a feeling for right now. We're like three-year-olds. We're hungry right now, and I know dinner's in an hour, but I'm going to cry until it happens. Because I don't understand an hour. I mean, what does that mean to me? I'm hungry now. Well, humans are kind of like that. You know, we say, no, I want.
And the kids coming in right now, I work with kids, they don't necessarily get the idea of the future. I mean, that's like, what does the future mean? And what is next week? And what is tomorrow?
Yeah,
it's all out there. That's a difficult concept for a lot of kids coming in.
I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. I like it when they say, I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. And they're 17.
And with the, you know, where they're coming from, they're closer to where they came from, being young, where the rules were different, where they may have been able to think a thought, and all of a sudden they have food, that sort of thing, if they had food where they came from before they came here.
Well, I understand what you mean, and I don't know about our concept of time. It's I barely can do it, and I'm looking at the wristwatch. It's sometimes it goes fast, and sometimes it goes slow. But I try to break it into moments if I can.
And I've noticed that in my work, it'll some sessions go very quickly, and some will be like forever. Depending on the nature of the energy of the day and the people and so on and so forth. Well, I'll let you go, Dr. Brooks. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. And I do apologize for the audio quality. If you're listening to this on archive, you probably won't hear it. But right now, at the studio in Paradise, California, and at my remote location in Mississippi, we are both being dumped on heavily with rain. And so this is having an effect on the quality of our connection tonight. So we might have little packets of loss on both sides for the live program and possibly for some of the archive, but that's the nature of the world we live in with internet radio. Again, the phone lines are open, 530-413-4511, if you're off-planet. And I'm sure you'll want to come a little closer because the solar wind is well up over 540 kilometers per second tonight. If you're east of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And if you're west of Earth, it is 530-413-4520. So I understand about the audio quality. I wish there was something I could do about it. But right now, Mother Nature is dumping on two ends of the continent at the same time. And that's why we're having trouble with our internet connection. I've got... if I go down and look at my meter, I've got a good, strong two bars of internet connection, which is pretty good. And I'm sure that in Paradise, California, they have the maximum. But it's funny how the weather affects the quality of the connection. And that's where we are tonight. I'm trying to close down as many things as I can, but it's just the internet connection. It's not anything else. It's not you. Now, I wanted to let you know that the Ark of Millions of Years, you know, the trilogy has been out there now for a while, 2006 or 2007, I think it was 2007, we launched Volume 3 of the Ark of Millions of Years. Great success. All three books have been multiple Amazon bestsellers. Now, fourth book is out. Why did we feel compelled to write a fourth book? Because in the first three books, we have about 1,500 pages of ancient history, the Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah, Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Book of Vu, all kinds of ancient records that have been kept various prophets and prognosticators throughout the ages. And we coupled that with modern-day physics and science and tried to explain to you what was being said by them and what they were looking for in 2012 end times. Forward Magazine calls it the most comprehensive work ever written on the 2012 end times. It has been used, the books have been used as textbooks on the university level. They've been used as reference books for making movies. There's another screenplay that's being written as we speak about another aspect of the books. I felt compelled to write Volume 4 because most of the things that we predicted in those three books have come to pass. So we wanted to document that. All the earthquakes, the weather changes, the planetary alignments, the discoveries that we predicted would take place in those books in writing have now taken place. And so we document these in the fourth book. It's very exciting to read. There's a lot of very modern stuff. It's so recent. We just approved the galley. It should be in print by the end of January. So I want to make you aware that that's going to be out. If you've bought the first three books, we're going to put a code out there for those of you that have already bought the trilogy that will allow you to buy the fourth book on a special rate. And yes, I will be producing an audiobook of Volume 3 and an audiobook of Volume 4. No, it's not done yet, but I'm working on it. So those will be available as soon as we can make those available to you. Don't forget, if you haven't already got your copy of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you might be in luck because there's a new edition out. It just cleared today. So Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all them, when you order the book from them, you will be getting the latest edition. This one's cleaned up a little bit. Also, the Kindle and Nook versions have been cleaned up, because the HTML code was a little bit different than what it would normally be for a website. These readers have their own way of changing pages from page to page. And so we had to go in line by line in the book and we put in the page change code in the HTML in order to make it work much more cleanly on the Kindle and the Nook version. So if you've got those readers, we applaud you because you're keeping us from having to cut down trees to make paper books. On the other hand, if you want the audio version, you're going to have to buy from the website. I have been thinking about making the audio version available to those of you buying the Kindle and Nook versions when you check out for your receipts. Right now, those are going directly to Amazon and directly to Barnes & Noble. But what you can do is come back in with your Amazon and Barnes & Noble receipts. We'll make that very clear on the website. Come back in with those receipts, and we will provide the audio version for you as well. When you use the readers, they have their own audio reader that you can plug in a headset or a little marshmallow earplugged and listen to it, but it's a computerized voice, and we felt, at least I feel, that it is a better experience if you get my emotion and my involvement in the creation of the word. So I want you to have the Kindle and Nook versions because they're great to read electronically, and they're easy to carry around with you. You can carry around hundreds of volumes. You go and read a few pages when you get a chance to stop or. The audio version is important too, because you get the flavor of what it is we're trying to say. That's all I'm trying to say here. So if you're interested in that, drop me a line, brooksagnew@yahoo.com or bagnew@x2-radio.com. There's all kinds of contact information there on the website. Contact me, let me know you're interested in that, and we'll make arrangements to get you the audio download. We've got about 5 more minutes in the program, and I know we've been having audio difficulties the last half hour as we're getting hammered by storms on both sides, and we apologize for that, but that's what it's like living on this planet. So what we're going to do is end about 4 minutes early, and and play the ending now, and we will see you next week right here on Radio. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Oops. Well, it would help if I had the actual stereo plug plugged in. Ran out of charge there, so I had to plug my iPod in. Okay, here we go. Time we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.